KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I want to tell people how humble and modest and reserved he is. He's an actual humble person, which is a rarity in the Vatican.
Pope Francis had welcomed the LGBTQ community into the Catholic Church. Will Pope Leo carve the same path?
Today is Friday, May 9th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, a former law clerk remembers his old boss, Supreme Court Justice David Souter.
Being in Justice Souter's chambers, working for him, working with him, just was really one of the highlights of, you know, both my professional and my personal life.
Justice Souter died yesterday at the age of 85.
Also, voices from Pakistan, where people are unifying over the threat of war with India.
And a profile of best-selling Swedish author Fredrik Backman.
Someone who loves being on stage and someone who loves traveling and someone who wants to be famous should have had this success. This success is wasted on me.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump leaves for the Middle East Monday. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump will travel to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates for his first policy-focused foreign trip of his second term.
The White House says the trip will highlight greater cooperation in the region, where it says extremism is being replaced with commerce and cultural exchanges. Trump also plans to visit with U.S. troops stationed at the Al Udeid Air Base outside of Doha in Qatar. Trump strode into office promising to bring peace in the Middle East quickly and stop Iranian advances toward becoming a nuclear power. He also wants to persuade Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel, joining what's known as the Abraham Accords. But those efforts have been complicated by the ongoing war in Gaza. And with little progress to announce, Trump and the Gulf leaders are expected to focus less on the quest for peace and more on making business deals. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Retired Supreme Court Justice David Souter has died at the age of 85. NPR's Nita Totenberg has more.
Souter, appointed to the Supreme Court by a Republican president, was an old-fashioned conservative who was initially a centrist on the Supreme Court, but as the court grew more conservative, he voted more and more reliably with the court's liberal justices. Political conservatives were so infuriated by his drift to the center-left that the next time there was an opening on the court, their rallying cry was, no more Souters. But over his 19-year tenure, Souter came to be widely admired by all of his colleagues. As Chief Justice Roberts put it in a statement on Friday, Souter brought uncommon wisdom and kindness to a lifetime of public service. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first Mass since being chosen as the designated successor to Pope Francis. Leo, the first U.S.-born pope in the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church, processing into the Sistine Chapel and blessing cardinals as he approached the frescoed altar. NPR's Jason DeRose reports.
Much of it was formal, of course. It was, after all, in the Vatican Sistine Chapel, and cardinals processed in their white chasubles and mitres. But Pope Leo didn't wear the red slippers that Benedict wore. Instead, he wore rather the black shoes that Francis wore. There were the traditional multiple Bible readings, two by women, one in English and one in Spanish. And the sermons started in English and then switched to Italian for most of it.
Leo acknowledged the great responsibility placed upon him before delivering a brief but dense homily in Italian on the need to spread Christianity to a world that sometimes mocks it. Leo will formally be installed as Pope in a Mass on May 18th. Stocks drifted to a mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 119 points. This is NPR. An international court will try Russian leaders for the crime of aggression against Ukrainians, and that has now moved a step closer to reality. Terry Schultz reports more than three dozen countries have signed on to a plan to create such a tribunal.
Meeting in Lviv, Ukraine, foreign ministers from almost 40 countries, more than half of them European, signed a document marking the conclusion of the legal framework for the new tribunal. It will pursue Russian decision makers for the crime of aggression in starting the full-scale war against Ukraine. Because Russia does not belong to the International Criminal Court, the ICC cannot prosecute Russian President Vladimir Putin and other Russian leaders, making a new body necessary. EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas is among its strongest backers and called for more countries to join.
Because if there is no accountability, we will see this happening again.
Former President Joe Biden had backed the creation of the court, but President Trump withdrew that support. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
It may not make some drummers happy, but apparently even a monkey can keep the beat. That's based on a new analysis showing chimpanzees drum with regular rhythm when they beat on tree trunks, in many cases with their own signature styles. Scientists looked at hundreds of instances of chimp drumming to come up with their conclusion. Researchers say it would appear to show the ability to produce rhythm dates back more than 6 million years. It's long been believed that drumming is a form of long-distance communication. The research is published in the journal Current Biology. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up more than a dollar a barrel to $61.01 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Scott Detrow on the edge of Vatican City, where there's a new pope, Pope Leo XIV. A couple of days before the world saw white smoke pour out of that chimney on the top of the Sistine Chapel, I had sat down and spoke with Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest. We talked about Martin's ministry to LGBTQ Catholics, and we talked about his participation in Pope Francis's recent synod on synodality, and we are going to talk more about Martin's experience at that synod now, because sitting at that table through the process with Martin was none other than the new pope, the first American pope, then Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost. Father Martin, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
What was your response when you heard that name yesterday?
Stunned. I couldn't believe it. In fact, when they mentioned Robert Francis, I thought, now what Latin American cleric with those two first names is it that I don't know? But it was someone I knew, and he's wonderful. It's a perfect choice.
What should we know about him? What was it like to sit with him at that big process?
Well, personally, I want to tell people how humble and modest and reserved he is. He's an actual humble person, which is a rarity in the Vatican. He's very smart. He's a man of few words. He's firm, right, when he speaks. He's confident about his opinions in a good way. I think one of the most important things to know is that he was the prior general of the Augustinian order. Now, that means he's the head of his whole religious order, which is elected, which means that all the Augustinians, known in the U.S. for Villanova, among other things, respect him, right? He has that background. He was in Latin America for many years, in Peru. He speaks Spanish. He worked with the poor. He knows the Vatican. So he really comes with kind of the perfect CV for a pope.
Just like anybody else, you weren't sure which direction the church would go. Now Pope Leo is in charge of the Catholic Church. You said your first reaction was rejoicing. Why?
I know him, and so I know that the cardinals have given the church a wonderful pope. I was also very moved by the choice of the name Leo the 14th. Leo the 13th was the father of Catholic social teaching, and so this choice of name indicates his alignment with the poor, with labor, with workers, which is just, it's just so beautiful. So I'll just say I cried after it was all over, and I was really overwhelmed with just how perfect a choice this is.
Is it strange mentally to have to think of somebody you know and work with as Pope Leo?
Well, I mean, one thing is I don't know him that well. It's not like he's my best friend, but I think it's odd. I emailed him a few weeks ago about something, and it's strange to have the Pope's email.
Yeah. You have to change his contact on your phone if you have it. I do want to ask about a serious question, though. Over the past 24 hours, there's been a lot of digging into previous statements, previous actions that now Pope Leo, then Cardinal Prevost, has taken. One area that's getting a lot of tension is the area where you have focused your ministry. What should we know about his stance on the big questions before the church and the LGBTQ community?
Well, I think he's been pretty quiet since 2012. That was a different time, though. I would say a couple of things. I found him to be very open, very welcoming. I think his first speech on the balcony of St. Peter's talked about building bridges and synodality and listening to people. And I can only tell you that he treated me with great dignity and respect and friendliness and courtesy and So I hope for good things from him. And I think it's, you know, as Pope, he's in a different position than he was when he was Cardinal Prefect of the Dicastery for Bishops. It's a different role now that calls on different skills and a different kind of openness.
You mentioned 2012. There's a quote going around of him criticizing, quote, the homosexual lifestyle. Your thought is that's not something that's especially bothering you at this moment more than a decade later?
Or no, because I think he's an open person and I know him to be open. And also the grace of office, as we say in the Catholic Church, means that he's going to be a different kind of person as Pope, and we have to sort of pray for him and be with him in that way.
Lastly, does having an American Pope change anything for the Catholic Church or for American Catholics?
Absolutely. I mean, to have the Pope speak in an American accent is unbelievable. I mean, whenever we've heard the Pope, he's, you know, even Francis, who tried to speak in English, there's a kind of distance, there's a kind of remove. And I think one of the things that just elated me last night was what this means for the American church. Imagine him going back to Chicago or Villanova or anywhere and being able to talk to people about the Cubs or the White Sox, and it brings the papacy closer to people in a way that has never happened before.
The internet was pointing out we have a big East Pope now.
That's right, and I know from my cousins who went to Villanova that the bells at the Church of Villanova were ringing all night.
That is Father James Martin, author and editor-at-large at America Magazine. Thanks for talking to us about this moment.
A pleasure.
So far in his second term, President Trump has sounded mostly in sync with Russia when it comes to the war with Ukraine. But very recently, Trump and his advisors have criticized Russia and sounded more engaged with the government in Kyiv. So what is U.S. policy now when it comes to Ukraine? To break this down, we are joined by NPR's Greg Myrie here in Washington. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Mary Louise.
And our correspondent in Kyiv, Joanna Kakissis. Hey there, Joanna.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Joanna, you start. I want to talk about the relationship between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It has been contentious at points. They spoke by phone yesterday. What's the readout on that?
So according to Zelensky's office, it was a friendly phone call. It's the second positive conversation between these two recently. Of course, we remember that striking image of Trump and Zelensky sitting in an empty Vatican courtyard before Pope Francis's funeral. That was the first sign of a thaw in that frosty relationship. And based on what we can see and what we're hearing, they've moved on. Zelensky said in this latest conversation, he emphasized the need for a durable ceasefire that can be enforced, not like Russia's three-day self-declared ceasefire, which started yesterday. Ukraine's military says Russia has already violated its own ceasefire hundreds of times.
Okay, so that's the view from Ukraine. Greg, what about the view from Washington? What's President Trump's readout on this call?
Yeah, Trump took to Truth Social and wrote, quote, "If the ceasefire is not respected, the U.S. and its partners will impose further sanctions." So this is a clear message to Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin. Trump also repeated his desire for a 30-day ceasefire. Ukraine accepts this. Russia does not. So this clearly reflects the change in tone, but does it mean a change in U.S. policy? Andrew Weiss at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is skeptical. He doesn't think Trump has changed his mind.
There's no indication at this point that Donald Trump, even if he's frustrated by Vladimir Putin's slow walking, intends to put serious pressure on Russia.
The reference there, of course, to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Joanna, jump back in here, because I want to ask about another development. This is the minerals deal with Ukraine that the Trump administration has been pushing for a few months. There was pushback from Ukraine, but yesterday, Ukraine's parliament overwhelmingly approved this deal. What changed?
So the minerals agreement that's been ratified now is a much better deal for Ukraine. Zelensky rejected the first version because Ukraine would have given up its mineral wealth and gotten close to nothing in return. Now, members of parliament agreed that the latest deal gives Ukraine much more leverage, though several still had issues. I spoke with lawmaker Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsade, and here are her concerns.
It doesn't have any security guarantees, and then there is not even reference to the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And unfortunately, the government didn't want to come and give us the answers on the questions we had.
So now she and many others in parliament signed off after some wording changes because they say, look, you know, Ukraine cannot lose the U.S. as a strategic partner, and this deal is a bond between the two countries.
Greg Myrie, any prospect that that bond, Joanna just mentioned, that it may extend to additional military aid? The current funding is running out.
Yeah, right now it still looks like a hard no. Trump consistently opposes more military assistance for Ukraine, and he hasn't budged on that. The assistance that former President Biden supported and Congress approved last year is running out, as you noted, and will mostly or entirely end in the coming months. Europe is providing assistance, may step it up a bit, and Ukraine is making more of its own weapons, especially drones, which are proving very effective. And look, a U.S. cutoff would be significant. Ukraine won't be able to replace the sheer quantity of weapons it was getting. Some of those weapons are only available from the U.S., like missiles or Patriot anti-aircraft systems that shoot down incoming Russian missiles.
And yeah, Greg, that's a really important point. Patriots make a huge difference on the ground here in Ukraine. Ukrainians are very happy that the White House has approved the transfer of one Patriot system from Israel to Ukraine. And that's because Patriot air defense systems are, you know, they're the best way to intercept ballistic missiles at a time when Russian attacks on Ukrainian cities are increasing. And these attacks are something we see and hear and feel here in Kyiv all the time. And look, you know, we're heading into the summer months when fighting on the front line intensifies. Ukrainians are desperate for some sense of normal life. You know, I read a report from northeastern Ukraine about a couple of women who even tried to use Russia's self-declared ceasefire to try to plant some potatoes out in their fields yesterday, and they were wounded in a Russian attack because of the Russian violations of the ceasefire. And that just underscores Ukrainians don't trust Russia to observe truces or peace of any kind, and they want the U.S. to help enforce that peace.
That's such an image, these poor women out there just trying to pull out their potatoes.
Yeah.
Greg Myrie, last question to you. It's the what if. What if this goes completely off the rails? Because there is potential for that. President Trump has threatened to just walk away from Ukraine if he can't get the ceasefire that he wants. What would that look like?
So right now it's a threat without details. We mentioned a possible end to U.S. military assistance. The U.S. could also end its diplomatic efforts. Now, if the U.S. does walk away or greatly reduces its role, this would seemingly play into the hands of Russia and Putin. There's a strong view that Putin is playing for time, that Russia's bigger and stronger than Ukraine and can outlast it, and Ukraine's Western support will dwindle over time. Putin may be interested in a ceasefire that meets his terms, like recognizing Russian control over parts of Ukrainian territory. But if he doesn't get what he wants, he may be perfectly willing to carry on the war, believing he will win a long war of attrition. In other words, Putin may think, heads I win, tails Ukraine loses.
NPR's Greg Myrie in Washington and Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Thanks to you both.
Sure thing, Mary Louise.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Former U.S. Supreme Court Justice David Souter died at his home in New Hampshire yesterday. He was 85. In a statement today, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote this of Souter. He brought uncommon wisdom and kindness to a lifetime of public service. Here to help us remember Justice Souter's legacy is Kermit Roosevelt III. He clerked for Souter from 1999 to 2000 and is now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
You know, relationships between law clerks and judges, justices in this case, those relationships can be so different, right, from chambers to chambers. What was it like to be in the Souter chambers?
Justice Souter was a wonderful judge. He was a great role model, and he was also a wonderful person. He was very kind. He was funny, and he treated everyone with kindness and respect.
He was also known for spending long hours in chambers, right? Like up to 12 hours a day. Were you expected to match his hours?
No, we didn't have to match his hours. So the amazing thing about Justice Souter was he would ask us to do some things, but not the kind of volume that clerks in other chambers often did.
Oh,
and then I sort of realized that most of what he was asking me to do was for my benefit.
Uh-huh.
It became clear to me that he really didn't need our help deciding. And what he was doing with that was really giving us the experience of discussing a case with a Supreme Court justice, which, of course, was fabulous and exciting.
Yeah. Well, Justice Souter was, of course, appointed by a Republican president, George H.W. Bush. But he came to surprise, perhaps disappoint, many conservatives, right, by often joining the court's more liberal wing in later years on the bench. How do you think that fits in with Souter's overall legacy as a justice?
I do think that after the experience of believing they knew what they were getting and realizing Justice Souter was more independent than they had thought, Republicans decided that they weren't going to make that mistake again. So no more Souters mm-hmm. was the rallying cry.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got a bunch of Republican appointees who in their confirmation hearings sounded very much like Souter. They would say all the same things about restraint and the need to understand both sides, but they were more carefully vetted for their ideology and they were more consistently conservative. So no more Souters, I think, has turned out to be true. I don't think we're going to see appointees where the president doesn't have a pretty good sense of how they're going to vote. But it's a bad thing. It's not a good thing.
When you watched Justice Souter engage with the other justices, how would you describe that dynamic as a colleague, a communicator, a compromiser with the other justices?
Justice Souter got along well with all of the other justices. I think it was harder for the clerks sometimes.
How so?
We as clerks, we were only there for 1 year.
Yeah.
And we're ambitious young lawyers, you know, and we wanted things to go our way. But Justice Souter really didn't think about it that way. He had a much longer perspective. I do remember once we drafted a majority opinion and there was this very vicious Scalia dissent.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sort of horrified at the things that Justice Scalia was saying.
Uh-huh.
But Justice Souter said, oh, that's just Nino being Nino. You know, he didn't take offense.
Is there a particular memory or moment outside of working on a case that stays with you?
Well, outside of working on a case, I guess I remember the afternoon that he took all his clerks to the National Portrait Gallery.
Huh.
We went through and he told us to pick out the one thing that we would want to steal if we could.
Oh, I love that.
I sort of liked
naughty.
Because of course he never would have stolen a painting from the National Portrait Gallery.
Uh-huh.
But I think it showed his understanding that you need to figure out what you value in life and grab that.
Kermit Roosevelt III, former clerk to Supreme Court Justice David Souter, thank you so much for helping us remember your former boss.
Thank you for having me.
when President Trump heads to Saudi Arabia next week, so will some of the nation's top business leaders. Trump is looking for a repeat of his first foreign trip as president in 2017, when he also visited the kingdom and announced billions of dollars in Saudi investment in U.S. companies. NPR's senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith has more.
In Riyadh, President Trump was given an extravagant welcome. There was a traditional sword dance, a new counterterrorism center symbolically activated by a glowing orb, and the promise of arms sales.
Hundreds of billions of dollars of investments into the United States and jobs, jobs, jobs.
Then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson announced nearly $110 billion in arms sales, with potential other investments growing to as much as $350 billion.
These are going to result in literally hundreds of thousands of American jobs.
But the numbers were squishy. Some of the deals had been announced months before the trip. Others were at such preliminary stages there was no guarantee they would pan out. The Trump administration at the time did not publicly release a complete, detailed list of projects and planned weapon sales.
Was the deal even really what it said in the first place? And the answer to that is no.
Becca Wasser is at the Center for a New American Security, a think tank with strong ties to the Democratic Party. I called her asking for help trying to figure out how many of the arms sales actually went ahead.
Because in 2017, this was really just, you know, a mirage, if you will, of a larger deal. It's really unclear what actually went through and when. Also, arms sales are notoriously hard to track.
The State Department says that since Trump's 2017 trip, the U.S. government has implemented $30 billion in foreign military sales cases with Saudi Arabia. Put another way, when Trump announced U.S. companies would sell $110 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, that was only just the beginning. John Parachini is a senior defense researcher at the RAND Corporation.
There are a lot of steps in any arms sales process.
A process that involves complex negotiations, multiple federal agencies, Congress, arms manufacturers, and the customer countries. But that complexity wasn't part of how Trump sold it.
That's the style of this particular president. He's wanting to send a strong signal that he's supporting American business. But these things are really complicated and can take years.
As for the commercial deals, many weren't made public. Back in 2017, one Houston-based oil industry supplier announced that Saudi Arabia would purchase 50 onshore drilling rigs over a decade. But in a recent earnings call, said only 11 have been delivered so far. It's not unusual for business announcements to happen during presidential trips and for the White House to brag about them, says Don Graves, who was Deputy Secretary of Commerce in the Biden administration.
There's some packaging that goes on by every administration. You're trying to market yourself. You're trying to claim credit for deals.
But he says the partnerships the Trump administration hailed in 2017 were far from done deals. Now, as Trump prepares to return to the kingdom, Saudi Arabia has said it is aiming for $600 billion in new announcements. Trump, for his part, says he wants more.
I said, well, this time they've gotten richer. We've all gotten older. So I said, I'll go if you pay $1 trillion, $1 trillion to American companies.
Deals are expected in the defense, energy, AI, and healthcare sectors. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
For kids in horror movies, where is the line between scaring and scarring? Producer Megan Lim remembers a scene in The Mummy.
The beetles under people's skin, and you can see the leopard move up their body, and then it goes up to their face. Oh my God. Oh, it was so gross. I would have a nightmare every single time, but I loved it.
Kids and what makes a good scare, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, people in Chicago can't get enough of the news that their hometown kid, Robert Francis Prevost, just became the new Pope.
Group chat's going crazy. My family's going crazy. We've already gave him a nickname, Southside Bobby.
How Pope Leo is playing in Chicago. That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A heat wave across much of Southern California today have health officials warning folks to stay inside and drink plenty of water. From member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Ahmet reports new records are likely.
The heat was already oppressive by 11 a.m. in Redlands, about 60 miles east of Los Angeles.
Oh, it is already 87 degrees.
Catherine Anderson sipped hot coffee on the front porch of her Victorian-style home, despite health officials' warnings. She wanted to get some fresh air and knew she better do it now.
This will probably be the coolest time of the day.
The forecast calls for upper 90-degree temperatures. For the next 2 days, temperatures are expected to be some 20 degrees higher than average throughout Southern California. Then, gray skies, what locals refer to as May gray, will be back on Monday. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ahmet in Redlands.
In Austin, Texas, a woman and her three children were taken into ICE custody this week and deported to Mexico, despite two of her children being U.S. citizens. From member station KUT, Maya Fawaz has more.
Denise Parra Vargas is originally from Mexico and does not have legal status in the U.S. Daniel Hatoum of the Texas Civil Rights Project says she was taken into custody by ICE after a traffic stop last week. Days later, she was deported with her children. Two of them are U.S. citizens.
What DHS is doing is it's taking U.S. citizen children and telling their parents that they will be separated unless they give up their home, their country.
DHS says Parra Vargas chose to take her children with her. Hatoum claims she was not given a chance to contact family living nearby who would have been willing to take the children. For NPR News, I'm Maya Fawaz in Austin, Texas.
Well, stocks finished mixed to end the week on Wall Street. This is NPR. A new report on how Elon Musk's businesses might benefit from the downsizing of the federal government is out. NPR's Bobby Allen reports Musk is the architect behind President Trump's cost-cutting entity known as Doge.
The group Public Citizen says in a new report that, quote, the wealthiest man in the world is working to dismantle the very same federal departments and agencies tasked with overseeing and placing checks on his businesses. The organization's analysis finds that Elon Musk has a direct business interest in at least 70% of the departments Doge has targeted for cuts, including laying off transportation regulators who would oversee Tesla's autonomous vehicles and layoffs at the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates Musk's brain implant company Neuralink. The group says Musk's SpaceX and X could benefit from additional Doge cuts. Musk did not return a request for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
The Pentagon is ordering all military leaders to pull library books that address racism, diversity, or gender issues. It's the broadest directive yet from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to rid the military of diversity and equity programs. This follows similar efforts by the Trump administration to remove hundreds of books from the libraries at military academies. President Trump also fired the Librarian of Congress this week because of her work on diversity and equity initiatives. On Wall Street, stocks finished mixed. The Dow lost 0.3%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. People in Pakistan remain on high alert as tensions rise with India. But as Betsy Jules reports from Lahore, the threat of war is unifying people in a country where many have become disenchanted with their civilian and military leadership. And a warning, this piece contains sounds of explosions.
When 35-year-old Shakil Shah thinks about a possible war with India, his main concern isn't his safety, but his livelihood. He gets paid by the day, and so every day away from work is a day without money. He says, how will we feed our kids if there's a war and we're sitting at home? Shah is a furniture maker in Pakistan's second largest city, Lahore. This week, the Pakistani army said that an Indian drone struck a military target in the city, and that has set Lahore on edge. But Shah says he has faith in one institution, the Pakistani army. Thank God, he says. We're proud of our army. We know they are there for our protection. First, he says, the enemy will have to face them before they can reach us. India launched a series of strikes on Pakistan overnight Wednesday. This is audio of those strikes published by Pakistani media. The following day, India fanned drones across the border, including into Lahore. India said it was in response to a militant attack in late April, where gunmen killed 26 people. Mostly Indian tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir. India claims the militants were in some way proxies of the Pakistani military. Pakistan denies any connection to the attack and says it will defend itself. Pakistanis have long rallied around their military, particularly in times of crisis. Rasul Baksh Rais is a professor emeritus at Qadiazm University in Islamabad.
Military is obviously a force that takes the hit, and the people think that it is their national responsibility to stand with them.
But public backing of the army has been shaken in the past 2 years, particularly after former Prime Minister Imran Khan was removed from power and later imprisoned on corruption charges. He's arguably the country's most popular leader. Many of his supporters blamed the military for his ouster, and exactly 2 years ago today, some of them stormed several military sites around the country. Rais says now, with possible war with India looming, many Pakistanis are putting these grievances on pause.
People will continue to question military's interference in politics, but at the same time would not like to appear to be speaking against it when it confronts the military might of India.
The military is also seizing on this opportunity. This is a social media video published this week by the army's media wing. It shows videos of tanks, marching soldiers, and fiery explosions. Pakistanis are now waiting to see how long their military and India will trade blows. Both countries have been using drones, and they've intensified shelling across Kashmir. That's the Himalayan territory that's divided between India and Pakistan, and claimed by both. Online, Pakistanis are coming together to show support for their country. Bilal Hassan, a doctor in the port city of Karachi, says he has seen this on Instagram, where he frequently posts content for more than 200,000 followers.
Pakistanis, we disagree with one another a lot. We have issues with each other. We don't trust our systems. But, you know, when someone from outside comes and picks on us, it's like you just unite together. And that's what has happened right now.
Many of his followers are also from India. He says he's gotten some criticism from Indian followers, but some of them also share the same view as him. Their message, we don't want war. For NPR News, I'm Betsy Jules in Lahore, Pakistan.
All right, the NBA playoffs are in full swing, and the games have been intense. They have been closer, in part, because teams have been playing really great defense, really physical defense. A player even had a black eye after a game. But have these games been too physical. Some coaches have complained, saying referees have been letting calls slide while fans and players seem to be enjoying the heightened intensity. But what is happening? For help understanding this, we have called up David Dennis Jr., as we often do, to give context in the sports world. He's a senior writer and commentator for ESPN's Anscape. Welcome back to All Things Considered, David.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be back. It's playoff season, man. Get excited.
Wait. So is this objectively true in your eyes? Have teams been more physical during this year's playoffs than in recent years?
I mean, I don't think this playoffs is much more physical than other playoffs, but the playoffs this year have been much more physical than the regular season. And I think we are at a stage, and part of it is just because of like what makes teams successful. And that is we have hard-nosed defenses in the playoffs right now. We just saw the Houston Rockets. They got eliminated. Their calling card was defense, was Ime Udoka as the coach. They lost to a Warriors team who turned their season around when they added Jimmy Butler from the Heat, and they became more of a physical team. They have Draymond Green on there, who we know can be a little bit more extracurricular in his physicality.
I also saw like 7 of the 8 remaining teams rank in the top 10 in defense. So could that also be part of why play is more physical in these particular playoffs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you see in the league and the NBA traditionally, a guaranteed spot in at least the finals or winning a championship is if you're in a top 5 defense and offense. So you can be as flashy offensively as you want, but if you do not have the defense, you're getting eliminated early. We just saw a Lakers team that had LeBron, that had Luka Doncic, that had, you know, 5 small guys out there, and they were trying to, you know, score as much as possible. Their defense didn't hold up, so they lost in 5 to a Minnesota Timberwolves team that's just better defensively.
All right, so that's why, in part, we're seeing a lot more physicality. But what has the NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, been saying about the more physical play these playoffs? Is he into it?
He's into it. I mean, I think everybody's into it because we're having a more competitive game right now. Like, if there's been criticism of the NBA, it's that during the regular season, the players just do not have that intensity from day to day. And who could really blame them, right? Like, you see that players get worn out.
Yeah,
and if you have an injury,
yeah,
it's unsustainable. If you have an injury in April or May in the playoffs, your team is done, right? You would rather, you know, rest as much as possible and not go 100%. If I'm going to play 75% in December in a game in Orlando, I'm going to do that. But come April, May, and June, you're going to see a level of physicality and intensity that harkens back to the old time of the NBA when everybody loved it.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody's doing.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I have heard a lot of critics say in the 1990s, basketball as a game was just more physical. And then things kind of got soft over the years. Do you agree? And if so, what do you think changed to ramp up the intensity and the physicality that we're seeing in these playoffs?
So without a doubt, the rules were different in the NBA. You could hand check, you could put your hands on people more. In the 90s, the game was a lot more physical, right? Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, you'd have a final score of 70-68, right? There was like some terrible offenses going on, and the game was not necessarily as fun as it is now. Like, the NBA is always trying to find this equilibrium of how much is too much defense or too much offense, where's the intensity level? And I think right now in these playoffs, we're kind of finding a great mix of all of that stuff where it's really physical, but it's really skilled. I mean, we have seen in the first round and a half probably the most compelling few games that we've ever seen to start the playoffs.
You're making me want to tune in now. David Dennis Jr. is senior writer and commentator for ESPN's Anscape. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered. This next story could not be introduced by a chimpanzee, unfortunately, but chimps do possess some of the building blocks of spoken language. NPR's John Hamilton reports on 2 new studies that hint at the evolutionary roots of human speech.
One critical element of spoken language is rhythm. So scientists have been studying the beats produced by wild chimps in the African rainforest. Kat Hobader is from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. She says in the rainforest, the roots of many trees extend outward from the trunk above ground.
And what the chimps do is they take advantage of those because they make fantastic resonant drumming surfaces. They're actually drumming often with their feet, so they're using their hands to hold onto those roots, and then they're kind of dancing, and sometimes they're jumping between the roots and getting all of those different beat structures down, throwing a hand in if you want to get a little syncopated.
Chimps use drumming to communicate over long distances. Hobiter was part of a team that analyzed hundreds of recorded drumming episodes from several different chimp communities. She says the analysis confirmed something field scientists had long suspected.
Not only do chimpanzees have rhythmic structure in their drumming, but actually different populations of chimpanzees, the eastern and the western subspecies, they use different rhythmic structures.
The findings, which appear in the journal Current Biology, suggest that rhythmic structures were already around when the first humans appeared. And Hobater says rhythm isn't just for music and dance.
It's present in the back and forth of a conversation and the timing of a kind of, you know, a slow country drawl or a fast-talking city kind of, you know, accent or something.
Spoken language also combines a limited number of vocal sounds to create an unlimited number of meanings. So another group of scientists studied the call combinations used by 53 wild chimps in Côte d'Ivoire. Catherine Crockford of the French National Center for Scientific Research says the team would begin observing the chimps each day at dawn.
We stay with them through the day, collecting everything they do, every activity change, every social interaction, every vocalization, until they go to bed at night.
The team recorded and analyzed more than 4,000 utterances. These included examples of about a dozen different calls. Sometimes the calls were used on their own and sometimes in combinations. Crockford says for this analysis, they focused on two call combinations known as bigrams.
What we found then is that there is some shifts in meaning when these single calls are embedded into these bigrams, and that the meaning can change in several ways.
For example, a who call on its own often means a chimp is resting. A pant call on its own usually means a chimp is playing. But when the two calls are combined, chances are one or more chimps is building a nest. Previous research has found these call combinations when a chimp is sounding an alarm about something dangerous, like a snake. Crockford says it makes sense that chimps also use this ability for other purposes.
It probably didn't evolve just because once in a while we see a predator. It probably evolved because we need to somehow navigate our social world.
Crockford says the finding, which appears in the journal Science Advances, does not mean that chimp calls are like human words. But she says the presence of rhythmic structures and complex calls in one of our closest relatives could help explain how human language emerged. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A year ago, best-selling Swedish writer Fredrik Bachman stood in front of a massive audience so terrified, he was convinced he was having a heart attack.
My brain and I, we are not friends. My brain and I, we are classmates doing a group assignment called Life, and it's not going great.
The event was organized by book publisher Simon & Schuster. The audience laughed along, but it wasn't entirely a joke.
I am so good at procrastination that the only reason that I am here tonight is because I'm supposed to be finishing a book right now.
A book that he was struggling with because at the time, he was very seriously considering retiring. NPR's Elena Burnett talked to Bachman about what happened next.
The issue wasn't with the writing itself, but promoting it and those large audiences, that was taking too much out of Bachman.
I've just been dealing with it very poorly, and I felt maybe this is not for me, and maybe I should go and see if there's something else that I could do that would make me a happier and a little more balanced individual.
It was during this crisis of confidence that he visited a Stockholm bookstore and found it packed with teenagers who seemed enthralled by reading.
Yeah, it was a fantastic experience for me to have at that time, to see that enthusiasm and that joy. And I thought to myself, if this is the last book I'm going to write, what would I like it to be? And I sat down and I wrote the dedication page of the book, which is to anyone who is young and wants to create something, do it. The whole book came from that.
So he did end up finishing that book. It's called My Friends, and it's out this week. It tells the story of a young artist, his three childhood friends, and one remarkable summer filled with just as much laughter as there was pain. The friends do everything it takes to enter the artist into a painting competition and into a better life.
I went looking for that feeling that you have when, you know, someone you love, they're looking at a painting and you're looking at them.
For much of the book, Bachman keeps the artist nameless. And that makes it easy to imagine Bachman describing his own career when he writes that the character has, quote, grabbed the wrong coat from a cloakroom and was wearing someone else's dream.
It absolutely comes from me feeling that someone else should have had this, someone who loves being on stage and someone who loves traveling and someone who wants to be famous should have had this success. This success is wasted on me.
His success has come not only in the form of bestsellers like his Beartown trilogy and Anxious People, but also several screen adaptations, including a film featuring one of the most famous men in the world.
My God, the world is full of complete idiots who have managed to figure it out, and you are not a complete idiot.
That's Tom Hanks in the 2022 film A Man Called Otto, based on Bachman's novel A Man Called Uwe.
I still have days where I feel like maybe it was a trick, maybe it was a really elaborate practical joke.
During production, Bachman visited the set with his family and enjoyed getting to chat with Hanks and watch him work. But at the same time,
this insanely scary experience, just looking around at the set and thinking, do they know that I'm a fraud? Do they know that I don't even know how I finished that book?
That book was Bachman's first. He says many publishers initially rejected the manuscript, saying it had no commercial potential. But eventually, A Man Called Uwe found a home at Swedish Publisher Forum, released in 2012, and with American publisher Simon & Schuster in 2014. It had a 42-week run on the New York Times bestseller list. Its first film adaptation was Oscar-nominated in 2017.
The nominees for Best Foreign Language Film.
From Sweden, A Man Called Uwe.
Bachman flew to L.A., but ultimately skipped the crowded ceremony.
I went on a guided tour of Dodger Stadium with a bunch of old men who had no idea that the Academy Awards was going on. It was awesome.
His wife went to the Oscars in his place. Bachman credits her with handling everything based in the real world. Agents, publishers, lawyers, accountants, while he spends time with the characters he makes up. As for expanding that imaginary world, Bachman still doesn't know if My Friends will be his last book, or if he will be able to, as he puts it, perform the trick all over again. If he can, as he told that huge audience last year, he can envision a world where his biggest problem may not be himself.
I have no idea what I'm doing, but I became an author anyway. So you can too. And I hope that one day I will be able to tell my agent that the reason that my next book is not finished yet is because I was busy reading yours. Thank you very much.
Elena Burnett, NPR News.
It seems like every week there is a new main character, someone or something that the internet is obsessed with. I will say I spend a lot less time online and understanding these things than I used to, but luckily, All Things Considered producer Mia Venkat is extremely online and is here to make sure I do not miss anything. Hey, Mia.
Hi, Scott.
So what's going on? I thought we weren't going to do a main character this week.
We weren't. The internet didn't really provide for me this week, so on Thursday, I kind of called it. But then, boom, new Pope, and then boom, Pope is from Chicago.
Pope is from Chicago.
The internet blew up, and by 3 p.m. I realized we did have a main character, and it had to be the city of Chicago, and more specifically, the city's reactions to Pope Leo hailing from Chicago.
Yes, so I was in St. Peter Square covering Pope Leo in person, but the cell service was pretty bad because there were like 200,000 people here, and I missed a lot of these memes. Catch me up.
I want to say, obviously, we've been covering the serious and critical aspects of the papal election. You're in Rome. You're doing that. This is not that.
Okay.
I'm just here for the fun bits. So it doesn't seem to matter to the people that the Pope spent most of his life outside of Chicago. The city has claimed him. As you know, our dear All Things Considered director, Jonas Adams, is a proud Chicagoan.
Yes.
And he told me that him and his family were ecstatic despite not even being Catholic.
Group chat's going crazy. My family's going crazy. We've already gave him a nickname, Southside Bobby. That's how we're calling him. I know he said his name is Pope Leo the 14th. He's Southside Bobby the 14th. This is amazing. Chicago forever.
So Robert Prevost, no. Southside Bobby.
I don't know if I'll repeat Southside Bobby when we're over in the Vatican later today, but good to know.
So also my feeds have been flooded with folks celebrating the new Pope and the city's culture. Like this tweet from at Lewis J. Nelson, Chicago guy elected Pope. No ketchup on hot dogs now, canonical law. We have this one from at Odila Norales, Chicago Pope, Central Standard Time, now God's time zone.
Yes.
And then this one from at Vitruvius Grind, asking the new Pope why a loving God allowed the Dave Matthews Band Chicago River incident to happen. So I'm not going to explain that one, but if you don't know, you can look it up.
Can I say something, Mia?
Yeah.
I'm old enough that I lived that in real time on whatever the internet was at the time. We know all about it.
Yeah, and apparently Southside Bobby does too.
Can I tell you one of the few ones that I was able to see?
Of course.
It's Midwest Pope, so it's not Pope, it's Oak.
I also saw a lot of Duh Pope, obviously. But classically, Scott, TikTok had a field day with this. TikToker Maggie Winters posted a video of her as the Chicago Pope.
All babies will be baptized with the water from the Green River. Michael Jordan is now a saint. You have to go to church every Sunday, but you also have to once a week hit up a dive bar and do a Chicago handshake.
We have a lot to look forward to.
I heard that Jonas, who we heard earlier, wanted to play the Chicago Bulls entrance music under our reporting the other day. And, you know.
Oh, don't worry. We'll definitely go out on it.
All right. Excellent. That is NPR's Mia Venkat. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at Viking.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com.